You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. Welcome to this week's episode of Mysteries and Monsters. On this week's show, I'm joined by entomologist Carl Marshall from the UK's Centre of Fortean Zoology. We cover a wide variety of topics, including evidence of big cats in the Forest of Dean in the south of England, the Beast of Bodmin, as well as the wonderful world of arachnids and Carl's passion, microcryptozoology. It seems obvious when you think about it that if we're looking for sea serpents, giant lizards and Bigfoot, surely at the other end of the animal scale, there should be thousands of unknown species awaiting discovery. And we discuss these as well as a tantalising report of a spider that can glow in the dark. It was fantastic to finally speak with Carl, and I hope you enjoy our chat. Before that, a big thank you to my first batch of Patreons. So welcome to Carlos, Corinne, Dan, David, PJ, Richard, Tom, Wynne, and the Ghost Story Guys. If you want to join this exclusive team and get access to some exclusive episodes, articles, and a chance to win Mysteries and Monsters exclusive merchandise every month, just head over to patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters to sign up for just $4 a month. You can also find us on all social media platforms, and don't forget to subscribe to our channel on YouTube too. A big thank you to the Straight Up Strange Network, Dean, my brother, for his consistently excellent artwork, and my producer on this week's show, Brennan Storr. So, let's join Carl to discover more on big cats in Britain and microcryptozoology. My guest today is Carl Marshall. Carl is an assistant director of the Centre of Fortean Zoology, curator of the CFZ Big Cat Study Group, and the representative for the County of Warwickshire. Formerly a professional entomologist for a decade, Carl is currently earning a degree in biology and has travelled to Mexico, North Africa, Belize and Borneo searching for rare species and unknown animals. Carl, I am delighted to welcome you to Mysteries and Monsters. How are we?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
We're all right, thank you, for a pleasant spring's evening over here. So, first of all, thank you so much for coming. I know we were chatting off air. I've been a big fan of your Facebook group in regards to big cats.
Oh, great, thank you.
Something I'm a real passion about, but obviously you are someone who has an interest in a variety of wonderful and weird creatures from all around the world. But
indeed.
Carl, obviously, entomology is, for anybody that's unaware, and I don't wish to sound condescending, is obviously the study of insects, which is one of those subjects which I think is often overlooked in the realms of biology and zoology in regards to, essentially these are small creatures that not a lot seems to be known about other than the more common ones. So yeah. How did that interest, was it something that was born out of a childhood obsession, or is it something you graduated to through a general love of animals and found your sort of kinship amongst the insects, as it were?
I think originally when I was a child, my father was a taxidermist, so I would see all sorts of taxidermy animals, like literally big cats and deer and all sorts of things like that, just lying around the house.
Yeah.
So as a child, I noticed these sorts of things, and I just became very, very interested in it. And as I got older, I just started to specialise, and I just ended up going towards entomology, really.
Yeah, I mean, it is a fascinating subject, because I think insects in general are one of those species that there are so many varieties and adaptations and symbiotic relationships that when you start to peel back the layers of information in regards to this subject, it is vast as a subject matter.
Yeah, yes, it really is.
Is there any particular sort of facet of that you specialised in, or you have a particular interest in any particular breed?
Yeah, I used to specialise in what we used to call the nasties, which tend to be arachnids, usually spiders and scorpions, yeah. The sort of things that will kill you when you if they tag you. So I used to do that a lot of the time. as curator of insects at the Butterfly Farm, that was one of my main responsibilities. Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's one of those things. I'm one of those people that I have a healthy respect, especially for spiders. I think they're fabulous creatures. And I obviously understand why they cause such an emotional reaction in some people, even for the smallest of spiders. So did you deal with, you know, some of the most well-known breeds in regards to that? Because I think it's one of those things, especially when you think about spiders in America and Australia, there are some tiny arachnids that pack a hell of a punch.
Yeah, the two most dangerous species that I've dealt with on a regular basis was the black widow spider and the Brazilian wandering spider. I mean, the Brazilian wandering spider is a far, far more dangerous spider than a black widow spider. A black widow spider is quite inoffensive, really.
Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things, obviously, because the UK has seen a proliferation of the black widow's relative, the false widow.
Yes.
Which can obviously give you quite a nasty shock and can cause anaphylactic shock in some individuals, I believe.
It can, yeah. I think it's mainly when the spider... I mean, all spiders have their fangs, if you like, on the underside, so they come into contact with the ground, and if they come into contact with the ground, they can pick up pathogens. I mean, even MRSA can be picked up off the soil, and if you get bitten by a spider, it's not necessarily always the venom type that's doing the damage, but you hear about these necrotic bites in the newspapers, don't you, and you see horrible pictures. And I think that's basically down to secondary infection.
So did you sort of milk any of these spiders? Because I know there's a lot of work in regards to anti-venom that's done based on that. Does it work on the same principle as reptiles, Carl?
You can milk tarantulas in the way that you're thinking of.
Yes.
But with smaller aranomorphic spiders like black widows and things, do you have to stimulate them with electricity? And no, I haven't done that.
Oh, goodness. Yeah, that certainly sounds that. So how did you sort of find your development from this professional grounding led you into the wonderful word of cryptozoology?
The muddy field of cryptozoology. Yeah. I've got basically same as everybody else, really. I think it's the old chestnut that my mother bought me on the track of unknown animals when I was a child. And I'm sure you've heard that quite a few times in these interviews. But that's the truth of it. My mother bought me on the track of unknown animals when I was a child, and I just got into cryptozoology from there. I later came across Carl Schuker's works, most notably the Mystery Cats of the World, which got me into British cryptozoology and ABC research.
Yeah.
And then I got into contact with John Downes, and this was probably about 10, 12 years ago, and we've been working together ever since.
Yeah, fantastic. So as part of that, as I touched on in your introduction, you basically, are you kind of the touch point for your area where if there's anything weird reported, you're the person that's out there on the prowl?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah.
Yeah. So, big cats in Britain is one of those subjects that I still find it perplexing that for a lot of people, they just dismiss it out of hand, Carl, completely.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and there have been numerous incidents over the years where someone's seen something and it ends up being a fat tabby cat from down the end of the road. However, I'm one of those people, once again, mentioning Dr. Carl there, who read that fantastic article he did about 10 years ago in the Fortean Times about the wide variety and variation of alien species that had been killed or encountered in the UK. Now, there's a lot of... I don't know if it's necessarily an urban myth, Carl, but I think for a lot of people, everybody points at that precise moment in the 70s where keeping a pet lion or a leopard was suddenly frowned upon by the government of the time and they were banned. Now, in your professional opinion, Carl, do you believe that these sightings were spurred on by reckless owners just releasing them into the wild and they've thrived as animals often find a way? Or do you think there's more to it than that?
Well, it's I would say that the media got involved in the big cat phenomenon in about 1959 when the Surrey Puma first came about. That existed on into the 70s. 1963, you had Shooter's Hill Cheetah, which was probably not a cheetah at all. It was usually described as a tawny-coloured, long-tailed cat. That was spotted a few times. Then going into the 1980s, you have the Beast of Exmoor, and in the 1990s, the Beast of Bodmin. And these are all supposed to be animals that have come from the, well, maybe not the Surrey Puma and the Shooter's Hill Cheetah, but they, you know, they're supposed to be animals that were pets that have been released. The problem is that there's a lot of reports that go back a long, long way further than that. For instance, William Cobbett's Rural Rides, the book Rural Rides, he describes in that as a young boy in, I think it was the 1760s, he said he saw a cat about the size of a mid-sized spaniel dog. he later, in America, said he saw a lynx, a North American lynx, and he believed it was the same cat. So yeah, I would say there's a very good chance that all sorts of exotic species have been introduced for various reasons over the years. But yeah, I would say that most of them are at least the descendants of their pets.
Yeah, I mean, it is one of those things that I think it's fairly recent in history. That I sometimes still find quite strange that people didn't seem to think that keeping big cats as pets could be an issue. And I know everybody knows the probably the best known example of that is Christian the Lion, that was purchased from the pet department in Harrods, which is a remarkable thing that you could go to a department store in London and just say, oh yes, I'll take that lion, please. And obviously the rest of that story is one of those wonderfully heartwarming stories that does bring a tear to the eye. And it's also interesting because I know I was speaking to one of my previous guests, Luke Phillips, the author, and he pointed out that they made it illegal to keep them, but did it take something like another decade until they actually made it illegal to release them?
Yeah, that's right. Crazy, isn't it?
I think that's if anything shows the inaction of government legislation, that's it.
It certainly does, yeah.
I mean, how many of these, you know, because I know there's always the reports of its, you know, circus owners and certain things have always been that. So I think me and you are of the same opinion, Carl, that we both think that there are some credible situations here in the United Kingdom in regards to this, and I know some people, especially in America, they don't seem to understand why we find these ABCs so intriguing, because to them they're just mountain lions or jaguars or, you know, whereas for us here, as I was saying to somebody earlier on, I was talking to an American guy, you know, we're used to dealing with an angry badger or a grumpy fox. You know, supposedly that's as scary as it might get. Or a fairly large stag. In regards to this, in your experience, and I know you've gone out and investigated a lot of cases, Carl.
Yeah.
Do you just think that this is people with not a lot to do, or like myself, there's a lot of credible sightings out there and a lot of credible witnesses?
There are. The problem is that because there's no sort of peer-reviewed system, whenever the media puts out a regional big cat, you know, the Beast of wherever, it becomes set in stone, and then everybody has the idea then that there is this so-called beast in the area, and then you get a lot of follow-up sightings which are probably not actually related to the original sighting at all. I mean, if you listen to the average, you know, the average newsreader or whatever, or even the average big cat researcher, they will tell you that there's, you know, maybe 500 to 1,000 of these animals roaming around the country, somehow not leaving any evidence whatsoever, which can't be the case. That's completely impossible. But if you bear in mind that in the national parks of Kenya, there's about one leopard every 10 square kilometres. In the UK, it's going to be more like, I don't know, maybe like one in every 500 square kilometres, you know, because they've got huge ranges, and we're talking about at the very, you know, somewhere between 50 and 150 animals countrywide, which isn't that many, really. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and that's the other thing about big cats as well is they do love to roam.
They do, yeah, especially pumas.
Yeah. I mean, the other aspect to all this that obviously adds a little bit of mystery to it all is that a large proportion of these sightings, they seem to be melanistic, which, as constantly pointed out by skeptics, a very small amount of big cats in the wild do end up developing. I know there are a couple of species, I think, that the melanistic gene seems to be more prevalent in.
Yes, that's so, right. It's a bit of a mystery in itself, that is, really, because if you think about it, the panther, the black panther, is the most valuable of all the pets at that time.
Mm.
So I find it difficult to understand that people are going to just be releasing them into the wild and not so much releasing pumas and other species, you know, which don't cost as much. The black panther was always the most valuable and always the most sought after. And I find it quite puzzling that there are so many reportings of black cats. But then again, we don't know that they are black cats, do we? It could be a dark cat observed at night and it just appeared to be black. It's very difficult to say, really.
Yeah, I mean, that often tends to give credence to some of the sightings. They're one of those creatures that I think there are certain situations where I tend to view a witness report with a little bit more credibility than some others. And anything that's sort of skulking about, you know, at dusk or dawn tends to give me a bit more of a feeling of belief, you know.
Yeah.
For better or worse, Carl.
Yeah, absolutely.
In your experience and some of the cases that you've had the privilege of investigating, what do you believe in regards to a lot of these sightings? Do you think it's just people misidentifying things, or do you think that there is a fairly substantial amount of these creatures out there?
I expect that there's probably, like I say, somewhere between 50 and 150.
Mm.
And it's the ranges of the animals which make them... makes them observed so often, you know. It's not lots and lots of animals, you know, in one area. It's just one animal that gets spotted once or twice, leaves the area, goes somewhere else and starts a whole new wave of sightings. But then the idea, the notion of the original animal encourages people to think they've also... I mean, yeah, people see foxes and deer and all sorts of things and they make mistakes. And it makes it very, very difficult for us big cat researchers to know exactly what's going on and how many numbers there might be.
Yeah.
But they must be very low because they don't, you know, they've remained unproven. So they must be astronomically low, the numbers.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, cats by nature are very intelligent. They're very, you know, I know people that can spend a day looking in, up and down their own house trying to find their own cat, never mind one that's living in the wild.
Yeah.
And obviously people always say, oh, well, it's probably just a feral cat, or, I mean, I've seen people dismiss them as Scottish wildcats, which are, you know, as rare as hen's teeth, some, you know, in most situations.
They are, that's right, yeah.
I mean, for you as a boots on the ground investigator, Carl, and a man that's got a passion for this, how many times have you gone somewhere and literally the evidence has made you really think?
Once.
Right.
Once in 15 years.
Yeah. And whereabouts was that?
This was in the Forest of Dean, back in December 2019.
Wow.
Basically, we went there with a friend of mine and took his son because he wanted to see wild boar.
Mm.
So we were going around the woods looking for wild boar, and he found a paw mark in the mud. And he's a very good young naturalist. I mean, I taught him what metamorphosis meant when he was about five.
Yes.
So he's really good with wildlife. He's a brilliant young naturalist, and he showed me the track. And I've got to say, it's got so many features that do not resemble a canid, and so many features that resemble a felid, it's almost obvious that that's exactly what it is. And I've shown it to specialists, and the last specialist that got back in touch with me was Dr. Darren Nash.
Mm.
And he verified my theory, and the tracks that we found and we photographed, they appear to be an average-sized felid, non-native felid.
Mm.
Probably lynx size, so either a lynx or maybe a bobcat, probably a lynx.
Mm. I once spoke to, because, you know, my friends have always known I've been a bit of a weirdo in regards to things like this, Carl. So I was very lucky about 10, 11 years ago, I got a friend of mine said, oh, there's a, she basically runs a livery yard in Derbyshire. Okay.
Yep.
On the cusp of the peaks, and she said, there's a farmer I think you'd be really interested in talking to, and she picked me up and we went to see him for an hour.
Okay.
And he was absolutely convinced that there was a large cat taking down his sheep.
Yeah.
And not that I was glad to see it, but he'd actually saved one he'd lost about 4 days earlier.
Okay.
And it had simply had its throat completely ripped out. And a bit of I think one of the back legs had disappeared, but other than that, there wasn't much damage.
Was there any sort of lacerations on the rear leg that was there?
It looked like something had grabbed the back end of it.
Okay, because dogs tend to snap at the back legs as they're chasing sheep. I always find that a good evidence for a big cat is when the back end, not so much the guts, but the rear limbs are unscathed, and when it's just massive damage at the front end and around the neck and around the nose.
He said he thought he'd disturbed it, and that's why there was a fair portion of it left.
That's possible, yeah.
I wasn't 100% convinced, but you know, I've known people who own farms, live in the countryside. I've seen the unfortunate ramifications of a dog attack, and it literally looks like somebody's let a bomb off.
Yeah.
Because it's such a mess, because they just go rabid.
That's what they do.
The thing that surprised me about this was it just seemed very clean and very quick.
Okay.
And I've seen enough footage on documentaries and things, especially in India where leopards prey on domestic animals, and it's terrifying. Mm. That they just come into villages and towns and just, seemingly take what they want. And it did strike me as a very unusual corpse. I mean, like I say, I'm certainly no expert in big cat attacks, but it didn't look anything like a dog attack in the slightest.
Well, maybe it was then, yeah. I mean, big cats in general don't like sheep too much because they don't like all the wool.
Yeah.
that's true, that is. They really don't. But, you know, if they get desperate and they have, I don't know, 3 or 4 nights of unsuccessful hunting, then it's quite likely that they would hang around the farm, and it'd be early in the morning they would do this because obviously they've been out all night.
Mm.
And they would go for a sheep and try and get it away. And maybe if the farmer came out in the morning, shine a light about or whatever, they might scare the animal away.
Mm.
Possibly.
I mean, would you say that that's probably what gives the situation in the Forest of Dean a bit more credence, in the fact that there is a very well-established wild hog population there, and would they be more to a big cat's taste?
No, they the cats of this size would be avoiding boar like the plague.
Yeah.
They're more likely to be primarily hunting small deer like muntjac.
Yeah.
Even pheasants and rabbits and things like that, they're really good prey items for cats. They don't need to risk going near farms hunting sheep and domestic animals like that when they can find... In general, they can find their prey in the wild, no problems.
Yeah. I mean, I've always found... The other aspect of this is that over the years, there's been some incredible first-hand encounters with humans and supposed big cats, Carl.
Mm.
And I always find it incredible that people go, oh, yeah, it was a dog. And I'm like, this... I mean, there was one guy, the famous... chap that I always mention in situations like this was the bodybuilder Anthony Holder, who lived in London, who claimed he wrestled one off for 30 seconds after it attacked him in his garden. And that was dismissed as a Labrador, and he was like, nah, wasn't a dog. I can tell you now, I was wrestling it for 30 seconds. That was
You'd think
dog.
If somebody got that close, they would know, wouldn't they?
Well, exactly, and I've seen 2 or 3 people over the years. I'm trying to think of the lady's name. Strangely enough, it was the very first time I ever came across Carl Shuker, because he was on I think it was an episode of Arthur C. Clarke's Mysterious Universe in the 90s.
Mm, yeah,
and they did a big cat special, I think. Primarily focusing on the Beast of Bodmin, I think. And they were interviewing a lady there who'd got like 3 massive scratches across her stomach.
Oh, yeah, that's not far from me, actually. That's just down the road.
And I, once again, I think she was told, oh, it was a dog. And she's like, it wasn't a dog.
Mm.
Do you find that frustrating? Well, you know, sometimes I laugh at certain sceptical explanations. But like you say, there are more than, you know, I can think of a good 10 off the top of my head. You know, people who have had first-hand, face-to-face encounters, and some of them have been quite fortunate. I think one young lad, he was about 11, he got scratched on the face by one.
Yes, apparently so, yeah.
Do you, in these regards, Carl, what kind of credence do you give these first-hand reports? Because there are only two explanations here. They're either making it up or it happened. Because, like you say, when you're that close to something, you don't suddenly go, oh, my God, I'm so scared I think that's a dog.
I think the Josh Hopkins, is that it? Something like that, Josh? Josh, can't remember what his surname was. Yeah, I think that was a bit suspicious, actually. I'm not convinced that was an attack at all.
Yeah.
I don't know exactly what it was, but it's very, very unlikely. It would have done a lot more damage than that if it had been a big cat. Mm. Just a couple of scratches on his face. You know, he would be really bad if he'd been tagged by a leopard. Yeah. So, yeah, it's hard to say, really. When we're relying on testimony, so it's very, very difficult, to be sure.
Mm. I mean, you've always got to, take certain situations with a pinch of salt, and obviously, as you've touched on, you know, the tabloid media loves a big cat story. I'm laughing as we speak today. There is obviously a story emanating from Scotland about a lady that's come across one, allegedly.
Yeah. Yeah.
And even snapped a couple of pictures, and already people are saying, yeah, it's a fat cat.
I think is this the one that's in the bush? You can sort of see it
yes.
in the bushes a little bit.
Yeah.
I think that's a Chelsea cat.
Hmm.
Which is a domestic hybrid that's bred from Fetish Chows, the jungle cat, and domestic cats.
Yeah.
And that looks most like that to me, I would say. I don't think that's a puma. It seems too gracile.
Yeah. Is that a kind of hybrid in a similar way to... I know they've started crossbreeding servals, haven't they, as well? As
yeah, they
pets.
Cross all sorts of things now.
So...
Makes it very difficult.
I mean, that is the thing as well, because... You know, your genetics only can be controlled so far often, and crossbreeding usually has, ramifications that sometimes people don't appreciate at the time when they start off with these endeavours, Carl.
Yeah, that's right.
Because, it's lovely to get these beautiful-looking cats, but that's not all you're getting when you start crossbreeding, you know, wild animals with domestic animals.
Yeah, there's a Bengal leopard cat, which is another domestic breed bred from domestic cats and the actual leopard cat. Not the leopard, that is. This is the much smaller spotted cat. They make a hybrid from those, and there's one that lives on the estate behind my house, and I see it about every 2 or 3 days. And I have to sort of double take every time I see it. Because it looks, because it is a lot larger than the average domestic cat. But that's what it is. It is a domestic cat. It's nothing more than that.
Absolutely. Yeah, it is interesting. So... In regards, obviously, as you touched on over the last 15 years, this incident in the Forest of Dean for you is probably the best evidence you've come across personally.
Yeah. So the evidence, I didn't find it. I was showed it by my friend's son. He was the one that found it. And the dimensions of the track, the shape of the track, the distances between the pads, the toe pads, the plantar pad, everything is indicative of a medium-sized felid, probably, or possibly a lynx.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised that there is... Because it's one of those arrogant assumptions, I think, that people always go, oh, well, you know, creatures like that can't possibly exist. And if... I mean, I'm very fortunate to live where I live, like I say, you know, five miles off the Peak District, you know, 20 minutes in the car, if that.
Mm.
And with half an hour... You are in the middle of nowhere. I can easily believe that a large predator could quite easily be existing up there, especially because we've got wonderfully weird populations of things like wallabies bouncing around.
That's right. Yeah.
And the Peak Districts are known because they've got enormous herds of deer out there as well, which are incredible if you catch them in full flight.
Yeah, and there's no apex predator officially filling that niche.
No.
So there's plenty of food.
Absolutely. And I've mentioned this a couple of times. I once
was getting a taxi to Manchester, Manchester Airport, in the middle of the... It was about 4 o'clock in the morning, and the driver was telling me about this enormous stag he'd seen, and it was always one of those, yeah, of course you have, mate, moments that you sometimes get into. And within 5 minutes, we rounded a corner, and it was stood in the middle of the road, and it's the biggest thing I've ever seen in the wild, in the UK.
Huge, aren't they? Oh, yeah.
And it was like 4 a.m, and it was sweating. It was enormous. So
that's very cool.
It was one of those things where you just think, I can't believe that's just happened. It's one of those, you know, wonderfully rare moments. Like, I was once in a traffic jam caused by a badger that was just walking down the middle of the road, and we were all just waiting for it to get off the road, and that took about 5 minutes till it decided to dive off into a hedge. So
right.
When you've got that kind of thing up there, creatures like that, they could quite easily, you know, as you've touched on with Munjaks and stuff, they could quite easily just prey on the young and live quite a content life out there.
Yeah, and I think lynx as well, because they have a minimal range requirement. Mm. A population of lynx could actually stay within the Forest of Dean and not leave, whereas big cats like pumas and leopards, I mean, I'm sure they do turn up there, but they're just passing through.
Mm.
But the lynx, there's a good chance that it's actually a population hidden within the forest.
Mm. I mean, it would be interesting, because I know that obviously... There is a growing fashion to support rewilding in the UK, and obviously the lynx is one of the three or four animals that is mentioned probably more than the others, I would suspect, Carl.
Yes.
What would
more,
you...
Well, they're definitely more reliable anyway.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah, I think, you know, lynxes know their limits, don't they? They know what to go after and what not to.
Yeah. I mean, the chances of us, even if we are big cats roaming around the country, the chances of us actually catching a black leopard or something is actually pretty slim.
Mm.
But if, basically, my idea is that if we introduce lynx into the Forest of Dean, if there are already lynx there, which will probably be more than one species, because they've come from, you know, domestic, they're pets and whatnot, basically, I would say that they're probably going to hybridise with the animals that are introduced, the you know, and there could be hybrid genetic markers turn up in their DNA, which might imply their former presence. That would be really good evidence in favour of big cats in this country.
Yeah. I think it's one of those things as well that when, you know, not being disrespectful, but I think anybody that doesn't really understand nature, when you mention things like, oh, we should reintroduce lynxes, it seems to cause panic in some people, as though they assume that these are lions.
Yes, people, yeah, they've got this idea, I mean, predators never ever huge amounts of top predators. They're always much lower because they've got to have enough food to prey on, basically.
Yeah.
But you try and get a farmer to understand that, it's very difficult, yeah.
Yeah, well, I mean, you look at some of the issues they've had reintroducing beavers. It's like they've reintroduced bears.
Yeah, that's right.
which yeah, obviously is another animal that they are considering. I think, is it lynxes, wolves, bears, and I've forgotten what the other one is.
Well, there's beaver, bear. I think the bears have actually already been introduced. They're in by Bristol.
Yeah, right.
Which is a sort of zoo. They're enclosed, but they've got a lot of room.
Mm.
And there's walkways, I think, above... I haven't been there, but there's walkways above the habitats.
Yes.
So you can observe the bears in sort of a semi-wild sort of environment.
Wow, I didn't realise that. I know there's something similar in Scotland with wolves, I believe, isn't there?
I think so, yeah. But again, wolves, they have a lot of problems because people are dead against having them back.
Yeah. I mean, it is interesting because I know one of the prime examples of the benefits of reintroducing an apex predator into an environment is obviously what happened at Yellowstone with the reintroduction of wolves there, because the populations of deer, I think it was, were just decimating the fauna, weren't they?
Mm, they were, yeah. We need to have a natural equilibrium, which only happens when we have apex predators.
Yeah. I mean, as obviously in these strange lockdown times as well, Kelly, it has been very interesting to see the amount of nature that's sort of returning. I mean, in Sheffield in the last week, we've had a badger in the train station and a deer outside a well-known sofa shop.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Just
wandering
around.
It took about two days and there were signs of these animals, you know, trying to take these territories back.
Yeah. And it's happening all over the world, it would seem, that the complete reduction in unnecessary transport and just generally people, it's almost as if it just reclaims it almost immediately.
That's right, yeah.
I think it's fascinating. I think it is weird how they can sense that shift in the balance almost immediately.
Makes you realise how insignificant we are.
Well, I think that's always been our problem, is that the concept of humanity is that our arrogance is that we are the most important thing here, and I think clearly we are not.
Yeah, I agree.
So, in regards to, obviously I know we've touched on it, I think the one that most people know the most about outside of the UK is obviously the Beast of Bodmin. Now, the Beast of Bodmin, I believe, was that the one where they ended up getting the SAS involved?
Yes, I think it was. It was either the Beast of Exmoor or the Beast of Bodmin. Mm. I mix the two up, if I'm honest with you. The Beast of Exmoor was the first one. So yes, it would be the Beast of Bodmin.
Because I remember seeing an interview with one of the marksmen, and he was 100% convinced that they were after a large cat of some description. He couldn't tell you what type, but they were 100% convinced they'd seen enough to know it was there.
Yeah. Yeah, the sharpshooters had quite a few sightings of it, and I think they took a couple of shots, but they never got anything.
Yeah. I think it's one of those things that, as usual, and you know, the other famous case is the Eurasian lynx that was killed in Norfolk almost 20 years ago now. And the police sat on that for nearly 10 years till somebody sent them a Freedom of Information Act, and they went, yeah, actually, we did kill one, yeah.
Yeah, that's right.
So,
and that happens a lot.
Do you think it's, you know, as we touched on there, that there's this misconception that these animals are highly dangerous? I think people think that they're just going to start running off with children from playgrounds and things, Carl.
I mean, that's not the case at all, is it?
Yes.
Especially leopards, they're very small and very, very elusive.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's not a big, I mean, they call them big cats, but they're not big cats, really, you know, they're pretty small.
Not in the comparison of them. And it is interesting as well, when you meet certain big cats that have been domesticated to a certain level, they do seem to be able to develop a symbiotic relationship with owners or people who kept them as pets. As you know, as I mentioned, Christian the Lion is a prime example. I've seen numerous situations all across the world with people that seem to have built a fantastically emotive relationship with these seriously large and dangerous animals.
Yeah, it's amazing where friendships can be formed, isn't it?
Mm. Is there any kind of indication or guidance in regards to that, Carl? Because it's not... They're not a kind of species. It's one of those things, and I've joked about it a couple of times, you know, like people who keep pet crocodiles and alligators, and I wish them the very best of luck with that. but when you're talking about lions and tigers... Do you think that's just because it's a nurture situation, or is it something else?
It's difficult to say, really. Do you remember the French panther back in September?
Yes.
Yeah, that animal clearly hadn't had any opportunity at all to sort of rewild itself.
Mm.
You know, it stayed around, it was being photographed by everybody. It was almost like it was enjoying the attention.
Yes.
But I'm sure that if that had happened in a more rural location and the cat had actually managed to make it into the wild, I think it would take between 6 months and a year before it'd be fully reverted back to being a wild animal and you would never see it again.
Mm.
Or would you?
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, because like I say, it's I find that kind of relationship between big cats and people very, very interesting, because it seems to defy the laws of nature, really, that it's almost as if they have the capacity to remember.
Oh yeah, they do, absolutely.
Because they're very intelligent and inquisitive creatures. Whilst keeping their distance, they like to, you know, they're not daft animals, are they?
No, and you go to the zoo, you can see them pacing up and down fences like they're stressed out. I mean, they're too intelligent, really, to be kept in enclosures, I would say.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like bears and primates, you know, same sort of thing.
Yeah, very much so, and it can be distressing. I completely agree with what you're saying there. So, in regards to that kind of facet of your love of that, like I say, I think some people don't understand why a lot of us are obsessed with them in the UK, but it's primarily because, you know, we constantly get told that there's nothing there, though witnesses, evidence, carcasses would tell us a very different story in certain areas.
Oh, yeah. There's clearly a nugget of truth at the base of this. There is a biological species that is the cause of it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I've met people who don't believe there's wild hogs here. And I think it's one of those situations, Carl, that it's going to take somebody to get a serious injury off one till people actually realise that they're... Because hogs, when they're in the wild, are extremely dangerous animals.
Especially if they've got hoglets with them.
Mm.
Then they are. I mean, they'll kill a dog straight away.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I once saw a fascinating program because they're having some real problems in certain states in the US, and they were talking to a couple of guys who were professionally employed by the local government. The state government to hunt them, and he'd got four dogs, this guy, and they were basically covered in Kevlar,
right,
armor suits, because he said the only way to track these animals is with dogs, because they're so quick,
yeah,
and so clever that they'll just hide away, and the only way you can get them is to get dogs after them to kind of, you know, track
and boar are very, very good at disemboweling animals. They haven't even got to use tusks, just the power of their nose alone can rip into the stomach of an animal, a dog, say, and be fatal.
Yeah, I was going to say, after I'd watched that documentary, I had a healthy healthy respect, and I knew that from that point on, if I was ever going to go into the Forest of Dean, I would make sure I wasn't on my own, have to say.
But then they should be left alone. They're fantastic animals, and they deserve to be left alone, not bothered by dog walkers and whatnot.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, and like you say, as with anything, most animals will only tend to be aggressive when they're in fear of their lives or they're defending young.
Absolutely, yeah.
So, moving further abroad, as I touched on when I introduced you, Carl, you've been around the world searching for rare species and allegedly unknown animals. So, in regards to your trips, tell me a bit about a couple of those, if you don't mind.
Yeah, sure. Borneo is probably the most success I've ever had in terms of getting stories. A good example was a giant freshwater crocodile.
Mm.
A soldier informed us of a massive, massive 30 to 35 foot crocodile that was supposed to be white. And he actually witnessed that himself near Loch Batik in Sabah.
Yeah.
There's no reason why you can't get excessively large crocodilians. They're already enormous. You know, 27 foot is not that unusual.
Yeah.
With giant pythons, some giant reticulated pythons from Ulu Kamanis, which is another area of Borneo. We were told by our guide that if we go in the right time of year during the wet season, that he can take us to a location where if we stay for, say, 2 weeks, he guarantees that we will find reticulated pythons larger than 30 feet. So we really have to get back out there at some point and follow that up.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've touched on this a couple of times when I've spoken to Richard in regards to snakes and crocodilians.
Mm.
They are incredible creatures. And in some of these areas, you know, as you touched on there, Borneo and places like that, they are certainly remote locations. I don't understand why there wouldn't be a 30-foot reticulated python wandering around.
It's completely plausible, yeah.
I mean, because you've got food on tap. These are, once again, extremely clever, versatile hunters. You know, they can climb trees. They can swim.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they can make the best of a bad situation, regardless, as long as the temperature seems to be all right.
That's right, yeah.
So, in regards to that, the crocodile you mentioned there, I mean, obviously the added aspect of that was obviously, was it classed as an albino then, Carl?
Yeah, well, he just said it was white.
Mm.
That's all he said. He didn't say if he'd seen the eyes or anything. He just said this giant 35 crocodile from Sabah was well known, and it had been seen quite a few times. He said he'd seen it himself.
Goodness me. Is it that kind of situation where the locals treat it with great reverence?
Yeah, almost like a god, I suppose.
Mm. Yeah, well, I suppose it's one of those where you try and keep it as full up as possible, I suspect.
Yeah. One of the most exciting things I felt was also in Ulu Kamanis, same areas where we heard about the pythons, we were told of what they were described to be glowing ground birds. Okay, and when I checked this out, it seemed that they weren't describing glowing birds. They were actually describing birds with a highly iridescent plumage.
Ah.
Now, it's worth bearing in mind that Borneo is, in terms of zoo geography, it's only a stone's throw from Papua New Guinea, where the birds of paradise are from.
Mm.
So it's plausible that there may be a Bornean species of paradise bird, and that is what that was. So that's something else I'd like to go back and check out.
Yeah, I mean, the variations alone in birds of paradise, their colour schemes are just mesmerising.
Absolutely spectacular, yeah.
So, and is it one of those areas where, you know, zoologically we don't really know that much about? I mean, obviously, as an entomologist, Carl, you've picked probably the hardest facet of anything, because it's one of those things that wherever it tends to, where people, you know, go investigating and the like, all of a sudden insects that nobody's ever even considered could even exist start turning up.
Yeah, absolutely. That's why I'm writing my book on microcryptozoology, because the microcryptids have the best chance of being discovered out of any other cryptozoological animals.
Absolutely. So in regards to that, is that specialising purely on unknown insects, or is it insects that have strange...
Any animal that's less than 2 kilograms, expected to be less than 2 kilograms, 4.4 pounds.
Mm. Yeah. Oof. So what does that cover? Everything from spiders to...
Yeah. Small mammals, small monkeys, you know, things like that. Anything. Basically, a cryptid has to be known. It has to have some prior knowledge before it's discovered.
Mm.
And it has to have an ambiguous element to it.
Very much so. I mean, I've always found it fascinating. I was watching a program the other week, which was primarily about the discovery of this incredible temple that had been lost for a millennia in the jungles of Central America.
Okay.
And the guy, I think, who they were interviewing, he said, "Oh yeah, and by the way, I've discovered 27 species of butterfly while we've been doing this." As a side, do you know what I mean? And I just found that fascinating, because clearly, you know, when you're in the middle of these areas that, you know, people haven't been for centuries, the possibilities are endless. Surely
there will be literally tons of small new animals to discover. There will be a good amount of medium-sized animals to discover, and I expect that there still are some large animals to discover, maybe even one or two true giants still hidden around the planet somewhere.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I've always found it fascinating when certain stories appear from certain locations, and it's, once again, it's the arrogance of discovery, I suspect, that people assume that we've mapped everywhere and we've been everywhere, and yet... Essentially, on every continent, I would suggest, maybe with the exception of Europe, and I know Europe's not classed as a real continent before anybody who specialises in geography tells me off. but there are, you know, there are areas of the world that we know next to nothing about, on land, never mind underwater.
Mm, that's right. I mean, I expect that there are large, enormous animals in the oceans to be discovered. Mm. And I expect that on land there probably are some as well, but they're going to be a lot rarer.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, is there any sort of... What I've always been fascinated with is out of all the giant creatures that seem to be mentioned or wherever, the possibility of giant spiders always seems to terrify people, and always people mention, you know, obviously Australia and South America as the two best places to probably stumble across anything. What do you put in regards to reports of giant arachnids up and down around
yes,
the world?
Yes, I would say that there's a good chance that there are some. Like you said, it seems most likely that they would exist in South America, because South America has the largest tarantulas we know of anyway, like the Goliath Bird Eater and whatnot.
Yes.
But there are some really convincing reports that come from Africa of a giant spider called Jabafofi.
Mm.
And as far as I gather, it's about the size of a puppy supposed to be and eats chickens. Now, that's not that unreasonable. I mean, for a long time, we said that we wouldn't find any gigantic aranomorphic spiders. That's the non-tarantula types. We said we wouldn't find any of those bigger than tarantulas because of their, how they breathe. But then, in about 2000, we discovered in Laos a giant huntsman spider. And the giant huntsman spider has a larger leg span than a Goliath bird eater does. So now we have an arenomorphic spider that is bigger, basically, not in terms of bulk, but certainly in terms of its leg span, than the tarantulas are. So based on this, then why couldn't there be a type of tarantula with a sort of modified method of breathing, maybe a different variety of buck lungs, or maybe even a branching trachea that enable it to get more oxygen, then it could be much, much bigger. Not 10 foot across or anything, but, you know, reasonably sized.
Yeah, yeah, we're not talking eight-legged freak size here, no.
No.
but
a spider as big as a puppy, that would be pretty concerning.
I mean, that's the thing with spiders. They don't need to be big to pack a punch, do they, as I've touched on? I mean, it is incredible. I mean, the Goliath bird eater is one of those fascinating creatures, because essentially can they grow up, you know, correct me if I'm wrong here, but are they on average sort of dinner plate
size? Yeah, about the size of a dinner plate, yeah.
And
it's got fangs like a cat's claws. Really?
Oh, it's definitely an episode for arachnophobes, this.
They're related in some countries. They eat the tarantulas.
Yes.
And then they use their fangs as toothpicks afterwards.
Yeah, rather them than me, Carl, I suspect. I mean, the Goliath is one of those things as well. Now, I don't know if... I'm going to throw this out there. It's known as the bird-eating spider, but is that a misnomer? Because when it was discovered, there was just a bird in its web, and it was eating it.
Yeah, I would say that there's a good chance that they do eat birds. Well, we've seen it, but they're not going to be jumping in the air and catching birds,
yes.
You know, like that sort of idea. If a bird flew came near its burrow, say, or even a bird flew into a nest of like a Nephila or something like that, one of the other types of ranomorphic spiders, and the bird would get trapped, or a hummingbird or something would be quickly become prey.
So, yeah, definitely. But I would imagine for those guys, everything's on the menu that they can essentially catch.
Yeah, pretty much.
Hey, dearie me. And as you refer to there, is it the perception that it's purely down to their lung capacity that restricts the tarantula from reaching larger sizes than we've found? But nature often has a way of surprising us. We've seen all kinds of varieties of the same species with massive adaptations across the board, Carl. So tarantulas as well shed their skin, do they not?
They do, yeah.
So it would be a case of, if it had the capacity, it would simply just keep growing to a certain size.
Yeah, if it found enough food and it was in an environment that enabled it to shed its skin regularly without any problems, they could get quite big.
Yeah.
And it's happened before, like I say, with the giant huntsman spider. Nobody was expecting to find a huntsman spider that size.
Yeah, because the normal ones are big enough.
Yeah, and this thing was, well, like I say, its leg span was bigger than a tarantula.
Oh, goodness. They are a fascinating creature. I just find them incredible because they are just a fascinating, intelligent creature. I think they often get a very bad reputation, as we've touched on. You know, thousands of millions of people have arachnophobia for some reasons. And but I just find them incredible. I just find their social order and their construction of webs and burrows and the fact that certain spiders have trapdoors and certain spiders have webs. I just find the variety of the species incredibly fascinating.
They're very, very diverse. I mean, tarantulas and, say, a house spider are about as different as you can get. I mean, they've got a whole different method of breathing, like we touched upon. I mean, there's only so much room within a spider for its muscular structure and where it breathes. So if it's going to have an adapted set of lungs, say, not lungs, but buck lungs in this case, they've just got to be evolved to be smaller. You know, if they're smaller and take up less room, so the spider can have more area within itself for muscular structure, then you get bigger spiders.
Is there any particular species that has a kind of relationship with spiders? Because I think the thing about spiders is they are voracious predators and are quite known for being cannibalistic if needs must.
Yeah.
Are there any species that kind of have a symbiotic relationship or basically build relationships, because I think people think that spiders will just eat anything, even their own offspring, if they have to.
Yeah, it depends on the spider. There are some communal species. I mean, a good example is the Psilophera, which is the ornamental tarantulas. Funnily enough, the ornamental tarantulas are extremely aggressive. They're one of the most unpredictable species to keep in captivity, but they're very, very docile amongst their mates, and they don't really tend to eat each other, and you can keep those together in enclosures, and they don't show any problems. But yeah, most spiders are cannibals, though.
I mean, it is often fascinating when you see certain spiders and they have like a massive bloom, and I've seen pictures from all around the world where essentially an explosion of insects will cause an explosion of spiders that will basically create giant webs with thousands of spiders there just devouring all these flies, and you know
that's
that
right.
Will only, no doubt, that would only go on for so long, or until the flies run out, I would suggest.
Yeah, that's right. And then you get spiders eating each other then. And then only the biggest survive.
Yes. I mean that's the other aspect about it. There is no doubt that, you know, large spiders in areas of South America or Africa, I would suggest that those creatures, probably the only thing they have to worry about are other large spiders.
Yeah, and people. Yeah, human beings. No matter where I've been, I've always found that human beings are the biggest concern.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm one of those people, me. If I've got a spider in my house, Carl, I clean round him.
Yeah.
Because I think I'd rather have a spider in my house than 20 flies buzzing everywhere.
That's right. I mean, the spider's not spreading disease in the same way a fly is. So, yeah.
Yeah, they've certainly got a bad reputation. I think they need a good PR run here, and let's try and make spiders a bit more... more environmentally conscious with people, I think.
Yeah.
So what else have you gone abroad on the search for, Carl?
I went into Belize in Central America back in 2010, where I was searching for a cryptid known as the Sisamite, which is a sort of large version of the Didi. The Didi is actually a cryptid from Guyana, but it's also reported in Belize. These are small hominid-type creatures. Sort of similar to a Rangpandek, I suppose you could say. But to be honest with you, I found very little evidence of their presence. I'm not the sort to find evidence all over the place. You know, if I don't find anything, that's what I report.
Yeah. I'm always suspicious of anybody that claims to have found a variety of cryptids when, you know, some of the greatest minds in cryptozoology have never come across anything. And especially in this day and age, with YouTube and things like that, I think the possibilities of new people on the block suddenly discovering, you know, constantly going in the woods for a walk and finding Bigfoot, I find that's the nicest way I can describe it.
Yeah, I agree.
So for you then, in regards to your book on microcryptozoology, is that sort of going to be based in specific areas, or are you taking a tour of the world, Carl?
It's anywhere in the world. Pretty much anywhere where there are small unknown animals that based on the same criteria as what Huyvenman's presented on the track. The only difference is that they are believed to be less than 2 kilograms. These are the species that I've got much better chances of being found, and these are the species that we can use to show that Huyvenman's methodology is actually viable. I mean, the thing with cryptozoology is we're searching for the cryptids that have, they probably exist, but they're just extremely rare, you know, and we don't know which ones are real and which ones aren't, so it's very difficult to pinpoint what's going on. But for anywhere else in biology, the microcryptids, smaller than animals, especially animals without vertebrae, they're going to be the most abundant life forms.
Yeah. I always find it surprising that, you know, once again, there seems to be this kind of assumption that there's not much left to discover. But, when you sort of drill down and take things to a smaller level, surely the possibilities are endless.
They are. They're absolutely endless. The problem is, though, with smaller unknown animals is that they're not reported quite so often. And so in normal cryptozoology, it's usually a case of the more reports, the better, you know, as a way of verifying what we're talking about. But in microcryptozoology, it's very often the opposite.
Do you think that's the assumption that people don't find they don't get excited about the smaller end of cryptozoology.
I think that's probably right. I don't know why, though. I mean, one of the micro cryptids in my book is absolutely fascinating. Mm. It's a glowing blue spider.
Mm.
Reported in 1923, I believe, by Barnum Brown, who was the curator at the New York Natural History Museum. He's the guy that discovered Tyrannosaurus Rex.
Yes.
He was in Burma, and he saw a glowing light, which he distinctly said was different from the fireflies that were sort of twinkling around him. And he got a bit closer, and he realised that it was a spider, a small spider with an oval abdomen that was giving off a solid light. So he took his handkerchief out of his pocket, yeah, got as close as he could, and tried to grab the spider, but as he went forward to grab it, he caught himself on one of the branches and made a vibration which made the spider drop to the floor and run off. He tried to catch it, didn't manage to do so, and it's never been seen since.
Goodness me. I mean, that wouldn't be surprising. I mean, obviously it's unusual for a spider, I would suggest, Carl.
It would be the only arachnid in the world that actually glows bioluminescently.
Yeah, because we see it in, you know, as you mentioned there, fireflies, and there are creatures under the sea that use bioluminescence, and, you know, certain insects, and I know that there was a species of frog discovered last year that that glows in the dark.
That's right, yeah.
So I'm surprised, to be honest, we haven't come across an arachnid that has that ability as well. Like, I don't see that being unfeasible in the slightest.
And microcryptozoology also is also interested in unusual behaviour, not so much brand new species. Well, it's still interested in brand new species, but that's not what it's all about, you know. I mean, this spider might be intentionally eating fireflies.
Yes.
To give it a glow, so that moths and things would be attracted to it for prey.
Yeah, yeah.
It's quite plausible.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm sure most people have seen, there are numerous pieces of footage of frogs and toads that have eaten fireflies, where they're basically just glowing away, aren't they? And other fireflies seem to be attracted to them.
Yeah, that's right.
So why not?
That's the ingestion of photoluminous material.
Yeah. Would there be a biological way that a creature could eat something like that and then use it to become bioluminescent?
Yeah, whilst it's still active, whilst the chemicals are still changing within the body of the spider as it's eating it, it would make the spider would glow. It would be a predominant glow running down the centre of the abdomen, which would correspond to the stomach, but it would also branch out into the other areas of the limbs, and you would just have a glowing spider, basically.
Yeah. So I would imagine it would be, you know, the brighter it would be would depend on it, you know, how much of it it's been able to sort of consume, no doubt.
Yeah, I mean, Barnum Brown says he lit a match first to see what it was going on, and when he lit the match, the spider became dimmer.
Ah.
And then when the match blew out, the spider then glowed again to full power, which implies it's either eaten photoluminous material, like we were just discussing, or it's actually a spider with a genuine bioluminous organ, which isn't impossible.
Yeah. I mean, like I say, My very limited knowledge on bioluminescent land animals is showing. But other than obviously frogs and fireflies and stuff, how common is bioluminescence in certain areas of the world?
It's very, very rare. There are fireflies, obviously, and there are a couple of other insects that are bioluminescent. There are a couple of snails, some millipedes. But so far, as far as we know, there are no truly bioluminescent arachnids. I mean, scorpions glow under UV light, but that's different. That's not the same thing as true bioluminescence.
Ah, very interesting. So, I mean, scorpions are a creature that I've always found fascinating as well, because they seem like an amalgamation of you know, a very intimidating front end, but it's the back end you've got to watch out for.
Absolutely, yeah. Especially the ones with very thin pincers and a very fat sting, they're the ones to watch out for.
Yeah, I think once again, though, scorpions do seem to get a bad rep as well, because they're often seen as terrifying creatures, and obviously, once again, I think most people's dislike of them probably comes from Greek myth, I would suggest, and Perseus's travails in trying to save Andromeda from the Kraken. But
definitely.
I mean, they are, they're fantastic. I mean, are there any sort of stories about large species of scorpions scurrying about in the far-flung corners of the world?
Not that I'm aware of. Maybe there would be more likely something like that in an aquatic environment, which is actually where the scorpions and the spiders came from originally anyway.
Yes.
So maybe some ancestral form that might still exist in the sea might be, might correspond to that, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. Because, I think, was there a fossil discovered a couple of years ago of a prehistoric aqua-based scorpion that was something like 6-7 foot long? It was a terrifying creature.
Eurypterids, I think they're called.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, I wouldn't like to... Yeah, that's... I mean, once again, why would we assume that there aren't things like they're still down there in the depths of the ocean when we know that, you know, creatures... that seem to defy age and time are still survive. Horseshoe crabs are probably the best example, because they seem to have not changed for the best part of 300 million years, have they not?
Yeah, and when they're babies, they look just like trilobites.
Yes, they do.
Which makes it even more confusing for the cryptozoologist.
Exactly, these murky waters do often cause much confusion, I suggest, Carl.
Yeah.
I mean, it is odd, though. I mean, I was speaking to Richard Freeman recently, I was perplexed in regards to stories of giant snakes. That we get stories of giant pythons and giant constrictors.
Yeah.
And yet the other massive snake that we don't seem to get reports of giant ones is the cobra. Because king cobras can be... I think the largest is something like 18 foot that's been recorded.
Yeah, I think it's 19 actually, slightly bigger than that, 19 feet I think.
So I'm always surprised that we know how large they can grow, because, you know, boas and pythons are usually in that range as well if they're allowed and they can, you know, function, most examples of it. Mm. So, I'm surprised to hear that scorpions seem to be the same as king cobras, but they don't seem to be... reported in, you know, there doesn't seem to be as many freaks or stories of large monster ones wandering around.
Yeah, they just haven't been observed, I suppose. And that's, you know, that's what cryptozoology is all about. It's got to be seen. It's got to have some sort of previous knowledge. Whether or not that's ethno-known or some dodgy material somewhere in a lab, whatever, just something a bit controversial about it.
Yeah.
But it has to have previous knowledge. That's the most important thing for a cryptid.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, very much so. I mean, what was it that took you to Mexico then, Carl? What were you on the search for there?
Actually, Mexico was just for insects, actually. That was with the butterfly farm, yeah, years and years ago. We just went there to monitor certain species of butterflies with the intention to bring pupa back into the country for butterfly houses. So you have to make sure a species is doing well before you can bring it into a zoo or whatever. So, yeah, that trip wasn't so much... cryptozoology, but after that, though, I tended to look for cryptids as much as I could.
Yeah, I mean, well, still, I mean, it's one of those things, because I would suggest discovering extremely rare species is as important as cryptozoology in regards to the discovery of unknown animals, is it not?
Absolutely, yeah. It's the same ball game, really.
Mm. So did you stumble across anything that you didn't expect?
Not so much in Mexico, no. I was quite lucky in North Africa, though, in Morocco. I went out to see the Berbers in their little tent in the Atlas Mountains, and I came across, well, I was pointed towards groups of dogs, packs of dogs that were sort of travelling across the sands of the desert, moving in a pack, going round in circles, like they were circling something. And the Berbers said that they were a Djouli, which is a cryptid known from North Africa. It's been known for about 200 years.
Yes.
So there's a possibility that I saw a genuine North African cryptid. Of course, it's probably more likely it was just packs of feral dogs, but they were certainly acting very unusual.
Yeah, I mean, I've had the privilege of being in the Sahara, and I've been very lucky to have dinner with a Berber tribe in the mountains of Tunisia.
Oh, brilliant! Yeah, it's an amazing experience.
Oh. Fantastic, it's incredible. And it's remarkable, because once again, there you are. I mean, we were in a little town on the edge of the Sahara, and I think we drove for nearly 3 hours in the middle of nowhere. It was just remarkable. And the strangest thing about that was, obviously, we came across a couple of tribes of nomads.
Yep.
And I've never seen anything like driving through the Sahara in a 4x4 at probably 60, 70 miles an hour and being chased by packs of their dogs.
Yeah.
Who were just going for the wheels.
Yeah. Did you see the goats in the trees?
Yes.
Yeah, that's an unusual sight, isn't it?
Absolutely. It's one of those things, I think people, because there's obviously a few photos of these things, Carl, around, and I think it's one of those things that people just presume that it's just made up or it's Photoshop or something, and I was delighted to see it because there was someone on my trip who had gone on and on and on about it not being true, and he never said a word the rest of the day. It was brilliant.
Yeah, you never know. Nature is a pretty amazing place.
Oh, very much so. So, for you, Carl, what's next on your agenda? Obviously, you're collating your latest book on microcryptozoology. Have you got anything else planned?
I'm planning a talk for this year's Weird Weekend North about big cats.
Yes.
But I haven't got any expeditions planned for a while, because I just basically can't afford to do it at the moment. I haven't been to the jungle since 2015, so starting to get a bit,
itching to get back out there, no doubt.
Yeah, pretty much.
Absolutely. Well, yes, and let's hope that Weird Weekend is rearranged. I believe it's September they're hoping to hold it this time.
Yes, hopefully so, as long as we can get this coronavirus out of the way.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, I was originally going to intend to go this year, because I think Richard fancies getting me drunk.
I'm not surprised at all.
Seems a rite of passage with Mr. Freeman. But it was one of those things that, since I've started doing my show, I've fully embraced it's one of the biggest regrets that I didn't start doing this sooner, but you can't change what's happened, Carl. You can only, change what you're going to do, and therefore I was really looking forward to going there, and obviously you were one of the talks, and I've been lucky enough to have a couple of other of the speakers that were going to appear this year that I've interviewed. Dr. Rob Gandy was one, and obviously Richard.
Yeah.
So, yes, I hope that it is rearranged, and I look forward to seeing you there, sir.
Yeah, it'd be great.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me today, Carl. It's been fantastic.
My pleasure. Anytime.
Oh, absolutely fascinating. It's subjects that I don't think get spoken about a lot. I know we've touched on ABCs, but I was very interested in your microcryptozoology as well, and the very best of luck with the book. So where can everybody keep up to date with your work and keep an eye on the big cat page and things like that?
Really, csn.org.uk is the best place to find us. You can find our Facebook group there. We also have a big cat Facebook group, which is what I'm curator of. Another good Facebook group as well is a group called African Cryptids. They've got some really, really interesting posts on there, so that's worth checking out too. But yeah, other than that, Centre for 40 and Zoology, yeah.
Brilliant. Well, listen, Carl, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking to you. Thank you for making time. It's someone I've wanted to speak to for quite a while.
You're very welcome.
And I wish you the very best of the luck. Can't wait for the book to be released. And hopefully we'll speak to you again sometime in the future.
It would be my pleasure. Thank you, Paul.
My pleasure as well. Take care.
Bye, mate.